Hello and welcome to this special episode of Freedom Books, Flowers and the Moon, the podcast brought to you by the Times Literary Supplement. I'm Michael Keynes, and the special quality of the following conversation will be entirely supplied by my special guest today, Peter Brook, a theatre director who says in his new book, Tip of the Tongue, "I never believe in compliments." So I hope we can agree that it is sheer fact with not a grain of false compliment in it to say that Peter Brook is one of the outstanding theatre makers of our time. His work ranges from Titus Andronicus with Laurence Olivier in 1955 to Marat Sade with Glenda Jackson in 1964 to a white-boxed circus extravaganza of A Midsummer Night's Dream at Stratford-upon-Avon in 1970. And that's just on this side of the channel. Peter's new book, Tip of the Tongue, Reflections on Language and Meaning, draws on a lifetime of bold, international work on stage, both in Paris at the Bouffe du Nord and on tour around the world, as well as on screen. As he wrote in that influential book, The Empty Space, which is just coming up for its 50th anniversary, the slate in the theatre is always being wiped clean. It's the impermanence of theatre that marks it out from the other arts. Shows may work in one town on one continent and fail completely when they go elsewhere. And the first day of rehearsal, The Empty Space suggests, is always to a degree a case of the blind leading the blind. Peter, thank you very much indeed for coming in. Normally, when interviewers give an introductory bit of rigmarole, they talk up their interviewee's successes. I wonder if it isn't, though, in this book, failure and mistakes and errors of judgment that are actually of greater interest to you. And when I say that, I mean that in The Tip of the Tongue, you write about things like the group who built a theatre in the wake of the upheavals in Paris of 1968. And what happens afterwards to them. And you also write about your own revelatory near miss at the Royal Opera House in London. What happened there, and how do you learn from things that actually go wrong in the theatre?
I think that you must look at it very simply. When you start on anything, only a fool will say in advance, "I know that this is going to be a hit. I know that this is going to work out marvellously." And I think it's the same for everything. Every scientist would agree with this. You don't start knowing that you're going to reach the point that you aim for. So what you do is very simple. There's a simple working method. You try, I think I write in the book, trial and error. And through trial and error, gradually, if you really go on and you produce with all your resources and all the resources of the people you work with, a whole lot of material, then gradually what's unnecessary falls away. And Gordon Craig gave this great answer when he was asked, "What is your working method?" And he said very simply, "Elimination."
Elimination.
And elimination. And here we are. I'm having to answer the best I can any question you put for me, but I know quite well that if this was given to me afterwards and written, I would cut myself 2/3 of it. So that's where one has to say that there is something very subtle that can come through if we just for a moment try the best we can and then quietly let be. And then that's what the whole part of the book where I talk about letting things happen, when I talk about the formless hunch, I'd had to have gone through all the impossibilities. I had this very early on in my career when people said to me, "If you're a director, a young director, you must prepare." So I took this seriously and I sat in front of a model and I moved the little figures right and left, and then I made little notes on the script. Take 2 steps here, right, stop, look across. And I developed a whole crowd scene that way with all sorts of things, music, indications. Had a great ball doing this. But then I came into rehearsal and just saw quite simply that none of it was any good. And I think all one needs is to be able to say to oneself, "It's no good." And at that moment, things fall away. And that's what the formless hunch is about. The moment you have to work with forms. If there wasn't a form, if we hadn't a table here, I hadn't a glass of water, you haven't got a microphone, mere microphone, we couldn't be doing this. But they are not the cause of whatever good may come out of anything we say to one another. That will happen, and that's why I say the formless hunch. People get obsessed with the form, and the form is just a starting point. It's something we need. In the way I write in the book a lot about that, we need words, but words are just a form. And gradually you can find that the word is either a dead piece of useless bone, or it is vibrating because within the word there is more and more, and that's what I wrote all about Shakespeare. It's all about that. That within his words, if you come knowing what they're about, if you come and you've studied all the professors and you've read all the footnotes, you are clogged, and neither you nor the actors can go beyond a certain point. But if you say, yes, you have to prepare, and now when you come to it, you have to trust the true magic of intuition. And the intuition only comes if you've prepared the ground, and if you then have the simple goodwill to stop taking yourself so seriously. And that's why working with a company is so important. Everybody at first comes with fears and egos, and that's natural, that is human life. But the rehearsal process brings you to something which eventually you need some spectators for the process to be completed, and then something more than you could have ever hoped for happens.
There is a very striking image in the book of the skyscraper.
Yeah.
And I think what you're saying there touches on that image, doesn't it? In the idea of Shakespeare as being, in a way, the ultimate theatrical, poetic skyscraper in the language.
Exactly. But in a skyscraper, you can't deny any of the levels.
Mm-hmm.
You go into it, you know that there has to be a basement. There has to be a rough, you know, an engine room, a boiler room. I mean, there has to be that basement, which is dark, smelly, and that Shakespeare brings into all of his plays. There is that seamy level, which is where you feel the grit and also the humour of more than everyday life, of what really is the dirty bottom of all our lives. And then you go up each floor, and each floor is taking you somewhere farther, and each floor has its possibilities. And there's no end. You can say, oh, if I've got to the third floor, and there are all these good possibilities, that's good enough. Mm-hmm. Or you can say, no, the sense of a skyscraper is, can we get to the top? And then, as in the history of most skyscrapers, you go up and up, and then there comes a point when the lift breaks down, and you go out, and you see if you want to get the top, it's like at the Eiffel Tower, you have to take the steps, and you go on, and that takes more and more effort, and then suddenly you're rewarded by coming out into something that you never suspected. For the first time, you're there with the brilliant light. The light that's above all the smog and the smoke and the dirt. And you're out there and you've got the sky and the sun above you, and you look down, and from very high up you see the reality that's part of the life that you've left and that you're coming back to, which is this ant heap buzzing and murmuring down there. And all of that is in Shakespeare, but while it takes me all this time to talk about it, in Shakespeare, within two lines, he can have take you to the highest point of, with the simplest words, like to be or not to be, and then wham, brings you down with a dirty, sexy joke. and that's all part of the skyscraper.
And you're back in the basement.
And you're back in the basement.
That's, I think, another thing, I mean, we can't conjure a second Shakespeare, can we? But there's something wonderfully described in The Tip of the Tongue about, which actually for me it renews my faith in the possibilities of theatre, having seen far too much deadly theatre in recent years. but you wonderfully described, again, it's another sort of potential failure. You describe a critic writing about a production of yours. When we came into the theatre, we saw an empty space, and then in capital letters you put the word yawn. And this poor person, whoever it is, has clearly completely missed the point, but within a couple of pages, so quite economically, in your own way, you make a kind of defence, really, of the idea of the empty theatre, the empty space. You know, the idea that it's not necessarily to be taken quite as literally as this critic did.
There's a skyscraper, and that word yawn. Yawn is really deadly. It reminds you of deadliness, but at the same time, that sense that at every moment boredom is just lurking to come in. I wrote a book, which in French was called, the title's better in French, Le Diable, c'est l'ennui. The devil is boredom. And that is, for me, one of the great helps, that when I look at the empty stage myself, and then I see that nothing has yet come to life, and then we make a few efforts, and I look at it, and I'm bored. And through that boredom, it wakes up something. You know, Stanislavski, it's something that's deeply touched me, that Stanislavski's last rehearsals, people who went to it longing to see the great master at work. And what did they see? They saw this very attentive old man sitting there. The students would come in with things that they'd prepared, scenes that they'd prepared, and all he would ever do would just shake his head and say, no, not that. It was never negative. It was such an impulse-giving thing of, no. They had to try again. That's where boredom also is a good devil.
Can be a good devil as well as a negative one, I think. Yes. The noonday devil of ennui we might speak of.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
I'm very struck by something you wrote elsewhere, I think, about seeing Brecht. You saw his productions, didn't you?
And
they're nothing like what you expect if you'd only read his theoretical writings about theatre. Is that right?
Yeah, because he was a great theorist, a brilliant man, a very, very committed, excessively committed in politics, but at the same time, part of him had an incredible talent for what we call all the aspects of production, all the aspects of it. So when he did a production, it was no longer what he was telling people to do and what his followers did, which is to try to use the theatre to express social and political ideas. It was to bring something brilliantly, warmly, glowingly to life through images, through things like Mother Courage, which almost mythical, and at the same time with images which demanded the best of the German theatre of his time. So he had all the after English polite West End actors, to see those German actors where you really felt the soil of the country that they came to. So that there were massive bodies which didn't mean to search for, you know, physical expression. Mm-hmm. They had the great presence that came really from the country, and they had really wonderfully developed voices, great intelligence, and not an intelligence that was being used, as Brecht theoretically suggested, in a dialectical, analytical way. They could just enter into a part, and the actors he had, the designers he had, the music, these were all, when he came to London, for the London Theatre, it was a revelation, because there was this appreciation of the arts of the theatre. And suddenly, here beyond this great German theoretician, here suddenly was the most splendid expression of pure theatre.
There is something that appeals to you, I think, in the acting of somebody who has a cameo in Tip of the Tongue, Paul Scofield, somebody whose gift was for an absolute practical, in-the-moment kind of acting.
In the moment. I think that is the essence, in the moment. That is where theatre takes place. That's why it's so concentrated. You can take an entire life. So many plays do this. I mean, in Shakespeare's history, he does a whole cycle of history, but into his famous 2 hours traffic of this stage, he can bring together what in everyday life is 20, 30, two centuries, or in one person's life is 70, 80 years, and all of that you can feel and experience vividly and intensely because there is this concentrating instrument called the stage, which enables you to enter into it and you feel it within an hour and a half, 2 hours. That's why the present is what it's all about. Theatre doesn't exist. People have tried to. I've known so many university papers, which is natural for students, but they have to write for their thesis a description of plays, and I've even read things written about my productions. I read something about King Lear. I was amazed. Here was a young student who couldn't have seen something 50 years ago, but he was writing from what he had read from other people and had seen in the college library, even clippings from the newspapers, and from that he was writing and actually writing critically. And he said, but that scene wasn't as good as... And here you come to the two sides of the whole theatre, the immediateness of it. That's why, I mean, I went through the different phases of theatre in The Empty Space, but in the end came to the only theatre that I know that has a reality, which is the immediate theatre.
I love what you say in that book about the rough theatre. It seems you've had so many experiences of doing that, just to shake things up, to see what's going to happen.
And it's very honest, it's very good.
But it also is a way in which you are not afraid to perhaps fail. I mean, there's something in the Threads of Time about being in LA and trying to get people just to turn up to a performance, but they're all in their cars. So even techniques, as what you say about Brecht reminds me, you know, that you yourself had to adapt and learn to many different skills in the theatre, it seems.
Of course.
You just learn what you need to learn. I mean, that applies...
You learn all the way.
You learn all... Exactly, you're a learner. You can't stop and then give up on it.
Because what you've learned belongs again already to yesterday.
Exactly. I mean, you wrote about US, didn't you, and how the production... In a way, the perfect run would have been a night.
Yeah.
Because things date. I'm conscious that we are talking in a day after the death of Peter Hall. And that brings to mind all that work. I mean, to put it no more strongly than this, all that work that really changed the way Shakespeare's done in this country. And also, that I think I've read somewhere, so again, I'm acting just like that student you've just described, but I read somewhere, and so you have to tell me if this is wrong, that really when you joined the Royal Shakespeare Company, it was on the condition that he gave you money for actual research, for experimenting time. That's not how it happened?
No. I came into... It was a great man who today should be honoured on the highest level, Barry Jackson. And it was Sir Barry Jackson who I was doing my first work in Birmingham with Paul Scofield. And one day he said to me, over lunch in the Station Hotel, I've just been appointed director of the Royal Shakespeare Theatre. Would you like to come with me? Well, I'm going to take my car and go over and look at it. And this fine, elegant, old-fashioned Birmingham businessman, who is a man of extraordinary, polite, courteous purity and of intuition, came and looked at this quietly. We went through the different departments, and he just said, it's quite clear we must change all this. And then he just said these words that changed everything, led into the Peter Hall era and everything that I've known there. At this moment, the Shakespeare Festival is reviving old productions. There's a repertory of, and they have just 6 days to re-rehearse from last year, 6 productions. Nothing must be changed. All the actors, the comics do the same business, but they just have to re-rehearse to get back into the machine. And with that, and no, hardly ever, a new production. And he said, this is, we must have at least 4 or 5 weeks for each production, so we must construct the season differently. We can't open everything in 1 week, which is what they used to. It must be spaced out week after week, month after month, and it's so gradually a festival through the summer, with events going right through to the end. All that came from Sir Jerry Bexon, and it was that Peter Hall then took over, and it was into that I went, still in Sir Barry's day, mm-hmm. did my very first production, which was Love's Labour's Lost. Then I did Love's Labour's Lost, I did Romeo and Juliet, I think Measure for Measure. Peter Hall came, and he invited me to join him with a marvellous colleague, Michel Saint-Denis, very fine French director, to be a little trio running this theatre, and he asked me, very generously, typically him, would I join him? And I said, yes, on one condition, that I can also start a little experimental group paid for by the theatre, facilities given by the theatre, but which is not under the obligation to give any results whatsoever. It is research. We see that without research there can't be creation, that the word creation, which is very pretentious, and the word research is pretty pretentious, but one depends on the other as an endless in and out flow. And he said, yes, of course. And that's led bit by bit to the Marassades, and then eventually all that we did after.
I see. So we could say, I mean, we must stop in a moment. But yeah. I think we're seeing that we're against the kind of rude mechanical approach, yeah. the theatre entirely, and the idea of having time and space for research, as you say, without being obliged to produce something at the end of it, seems invaluable.
Without methods and without theories.
Well, I think we can all agree that's a very promising way to produce beautiful theatre. Peter, thank you very much for joining us. Thank you.
Yes, sir.